This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Civilization as we've known it is coming to an end, brought down by a rapidly changing climate, a cancerous economic system, and the ongoing mass destruction of the non-human world. That's a quote and a starting point for our next guest, Paul Kingsnorth, a founder of the Dark Mountain Project. Paul is a well-educated and well-published environmentalist in England. He's been arrested at a protest, helped edit the Ecologist magazine and Greenpeace publications. He appears regularly in British newspapers, radio, and television. Paul, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks for having me.
Let's start with current events. Was there ever any real hope that climate change was going to be stopped by our current political leaders in Copenhagen?
I don't think so, no. Not at all. And I think that the conclusion was pretty foregone from the beginning. I think that one of the ways that we... Well, I think that the ways we look at climate change actually are probably the wrong ways. We look at climate change as a problem that we can solve within a certain amount of time if we can just get the technology right and if we can get the political will and if we can build a big mass movement of people. And I don't think that's really what it is. I think climate change is almost an existential problem for us. It's a predicament we have to live with rather than a problem we have to solve. And I think the root of that is the fact that climate change, we treat climate change almost as if it's something external. It's a sort of problem that we've created that we can solve with human genius. But I don't think it is. I think climate change is our society. Climate change is who we are. Climate change is our computers. It's our televisions. It's our flights. And we're all complicit in it, those of us living in the rich world. And the system that the political leaders who gathered in Copenhagen have to promote, because it's what their voters want them to promote and it's what global corporations and the global economy want them to promote, is the system that creates climate change. So it's almost impossible to believe, I think, that they can turn around and suddenly click a switch and turn it off again. And I think that we're having real trouble understanding that. I think that applies to environmentalists as well as to the public as a whole. I think we still see climate change as kind of a challenge that we can tackle with the sort of old-fashioned methods of protest and marching and letter writing and campaigning. And I don't think it's responding to that at all.
One thing brought home to me by the alleged leak of the Danish text is that we in the West are committed to the expediency of atmospheric imperialism, if you want to call it that. We'll keep polluting even if we lose whole countries or continents in the less developed world. Am I being pessimistic or is that realistic?
Well, this is one of the things that the Dark Mountain Project was set up to try and distinguish between pessimism and realism. I think that the whole of the kind of environmental movement in which I've been involved for a long time is built on this kind of edifice of hope. And, you know, hope can be a very good thing, but if it's false hope, it's a very dangerous thing. And we've almost come to believe that anything's possible if we just hope for it enough. And I think we need to take a cold and a hard and a realistic look at the way the world is and the way that human society is and the way that human society is rubbing up against the ecological reality. And that's one way. It's all very well, you know, taking to the streets to kind of urge our leaders to act at Copenhagen, but our leaders are running this enormous machine, and this machine is about cannibalizing resources from the rest of the world. It's about keeping the consumer economy going. You can't just turn that around however much mass public action you have. And the problem is with climate change is that actually you're never going to get millions of people on the streets to campaign against climate change, because they'll be campaigning against their own way of life. They'll be campaigning against their own comfort, in the West at least. And so we're all complicit in that system. The voters are complicit, the corporations are complicit, the politicians are complicit, and we might want to stop climate change, but actually I don't think that we can, at least within the timescale that's apparently available to us. And I think we need to be honest about that, because only when we're honest about that can we start to think about what we do next.
Well, that's a good point, really. And the Copenhagen talks have been a focus for so many environmental groups, and now that circus is over and the media will move on to something else, they've covered it, they'll say. So there's bound to be a letdown in the movement. What happens to environmentalism now?
Well, I think that if you look at the history of environmentalism, you can trace various different phases. Perhaps you can trace a phase of conservation environmentalism and a phase of romantic environmentalism and perhaps a phase of radical environmentalism. And I think we need now to move into the next phase. And I think what we need to accept is that we have hit and exceeded a lot of ecological limits. And when I say we, I mean human civilization. I think we have this idea that when we fight to stop climate change, or when we talk about sustainability, that we're fighting to save the planet or even to save the human species. And actually, I don't think we're fighting to save either of those things. I think the planet will be fine. It's gone through much worse than this. I think that the human species will survive. What we're actually looking at the end of is the civilization that we've grown up with. Now, that doesn't mean it's the end of everything. It doesn't mean it's an apocalypse. But it does mean that we've created this enormous edifice, this huge industrial civilization, which is cannibalized nature. It's changing the atmosphere, it's emptying the oceans, it's destroying the forests, it's exhausting the soil. We've got 10 billion human beings coming along who are all going to want to live Western standards of life, and it's not possible for that to happen. And that's going to be a hit that we're all going to have to take. We're going to have a real contraction in the way that we live materially, particularly or especially those of us in the West. And the question really is, are we going to do that voluntarily, or are we going to have it forced upon us? And I think, unfortunately, that the answer is probably that we're going to have it forced upon us, because I don't think that we're capable of making the changes that we need to make.
Yes, here in North America, Dr. Bill Rees has talked about a smart decline, but it hasn't caught on. And I noticed that your co-partner in crime there, Dugald Hine, has been working with collapsonomics. It kind of reminds me of the fall of the Soviet-style communism. It didn't go from violent revolution, but nobody believed in it anymore. Is that where we're at now, with the big dream of consumerism and greed is good heading off the horizon?
Well, I think that where we're at now is a kind of very, very slow, painful awareness that we are constrained by limits. And I think that's something that environmentalists have to understand, but more so, I think society as a whole has to understand. We've kind of been a very pioneering species, humans, and certainly for the last couple of hundred years, where we've been fueled by fossil energy, we've basically been able to do anything. I mean, we've gone to the moon, we've gone to the stars, we've conquered every continent on Earth, we've built amazing machines, and we've all grown up with this idea that we're going to keep doing that, we're going to keep progressing, we can break every boundary, we can do anything we want. And the fact is that we can't, and neither can any other species, and we're pushing the boundaries of what we can live within. And we have to start adjusting to the idea that there are limits and we have to live within them. And I think that's a real painful kind of psychological change that we have to go through as a species, and particularly in Western culture, which is very much built on that kind of imperial expansion model. And the technological expansion model, it's kind of deep within our DNA, and we really don't like the idea that we just can't keep plowing onwards. And I think this is where the kind of climate denial movement comes in, and it's also where some strands of environmentalism come in that believe that technology will solve everything if we can just get the alternative fuel cells right and all the rest of it. There's still this kind of almost magical thinking that we'll somehow be able to transcend limits. But I don't think we will, and I think that's what we really need to try and get a grip on, and it's hard for us to believe in, but it's true.
Well, let's talk for the economy for a minute. In the United States, Obama's chief economic advisor, Lawrence Summers, just told the press the recession is over, jobs are coming back in the spring. What is your impression of our economic situation in the developed countries?
I think, firstly, it's very telling that Barack Obama got Lawrence Summers to be to be in his cabinet at all. I mean, he's a very notorious kind of ex-world banker and kind of neoliberal hawk. So it shows you what kind of direction the economy is going in. But I think that what's happening in the West is that the same thing has happened here in Britain as well, is that we have borrowed vast, vast amounts of money that we can't afford in order to prop up an economy which is failing. But we haven't made the changes that are needed in order to make that economy sustainable. So I think we've probably created a sort of false dawn for a while. Things have calmed down a bit. Things are certainly not as bad as they were 6 months ago. But the idea that we've created any kind of sustainable plateau, it's been very interesting to listen to the political and the media debate, and maybe it's been the same there as it has been here. But as soon as the crash happened, all of the thinking was about how we could get back to how it was before. And we had to prop up the economy, we had to inject money, we had to pay off the banks, we had to buy up the banks, we had to do anything to get the economy back on track. And of course, getting it back on track means getting it back on the track of unsustainable growth, which is what got us to this problem in the first place. And it's socially unsustainable, but it's also ecologically unsustainable. We're trying to run a growth economy on a finite planet, and that's the root cause of all of our environmental problems. And that was another issue with Copenhagen and all of these global summits, is that all of the leaders there talking about contracting our greenhouse gas emissions are the same leaders who then go to another summit and talk about expanding the economy. And it's the ever-growing economy that makes these demands upon the planet. It's not just climate change, it's all of the other ecological pressures too. And, you know, we've got an economy which is, I think, growing like a cancer cell, and we don't know how to realign it. And until we've worked out how to realign it, again, All of this other stuff is window dressing, really, because that's the root cause of the problem.
Right, it's like cigarettes. We're hooked on growth, but it's killing us. It sounds, though, are you suggesting that collapse might be the best thing for the planet as a whole at this point?
It's a very hard question, isn't it? I mean, I don't think it would. It's a very good question. It depends what you mean by the planet. There's a very strong argument that plenty of deep ecologists make, particularly in North America, that the best thing that could happen for the global ecosystem would be the collapse of the human economy. And there's certainly plenty of evidence to support that. If you look at the biggest contraction of fossil fuel emissions, for example, the only time where any serious reduction in fossil fuel emissions has happened over the last 20 or 30 years, it was the collapse of the Eastern Bloc and the Soviet Union. The economy collapsed, and it immediately did a lot less damage to the natural world. But I don't think that kind of praying for collapse in any way is a long-term solution. It's also potentially very inhumane. It would be very, very difficult for people to cope with. And there's no guarantee it would lead to any better treatment of the global environment. But my kind of conclusion after sort of 15 years of environmentalism really is that collapse is pretty unavoidable. I think it's probably already started. Certainly climate change has started. I don't see any prospect whatsoever of keeping below 2 degrees of climate change. We don't know what the feedbacks will do. We've got a completely unsustainable economy that's just roaring out of control, bringing goodness knows how many millions of new people into it every year. Whether collapse is good for us or not, I think that it's probably inevitable. And so we ought to try and think about how, if possible, we're going to deal with that kind of reality, I think.
Well, in a way, you touched on it, perhaps some of the solutions, in your book, Real England. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with one of Britain's provocative public voices, Paul Kingsnorth. And in Real England, you describe the last truly British experiences as global business chains and mass marketing wipe out the last of the people's culture. And it's a little late for a book like that here. I'm surrounded by malls, and they all look the same. And we buy the package, and the brand name is really all there is. The box is generally kind of empty. Is there a movement in Europe to find more meaningful lives, shall we say?
I think there is. And actually, it's probably stronger in some other parts of Europe than it is in Britain. I think Britain is probably, unfortunately, a bit more far advanced down the sort of North American mall road than some other countries, but we've still got a fair bit of it going on here. There's a lot of interest in slow food. There are a lot of interest in farmers' markets. There's a lot of campaigns against McDonald's and all that kind of thing. But I think more broadly, amongst quite a lot of sections of the population, there's a kind of awareness of the importance of local economies and the importance of the local cultures that are attached to them. And the importance of resilience, because I think if there's one thing that we ought to be doing, whether or not we're facing a collapse, which I think we are, but even if we weren't, if there's one thing that we ought to be doing, it's looking to local resilience, community resilience, the resilience of people in places, the resilience of local economies and local economic networks. Because the thing about the global economy is that it's intensely fragile. I mean, a superstore in Britain, for example, will hold about 24 hours worth of food because they run these just-in-time delivery systems, and they're very efficient on if you've got a supply chain that constantly works. But if the supply chain breaks for any reason, you've got food shortages within a day. And this is not a resilient system at all, and it's not a very efficient one. If you suddenly got a problem with, say, your fuel supplies or your food supplies. So what we ought to be doing is building resilience, and that means cultural resilience at a local level and economic resilience too. And I think that's something that really can be focused on without having to wait for our leaders to go to Copenhagen or wherever and come up with a document. That's something that for most of our history, for 99.5% of human history, we've always had workable, resilient local communities. And what sort of global consumer capitalism, if you like, has done, particularly in the West, is it's destroyed those and it's replaced them with shopping. And it seems very pleasing to people on the surface, but as soon as the system starts to fall apart, it doesn't work anymore. And if you've undermined all of that resilience by doing that, then you're in trouble. So that's certainly one thing that, as you say, we could be really focusing on right now.
I'd like to get back to the Dark Mountain Project. Listeners can Google that or just go to dark-mountain.net. It's a flashpoint for those who see our present society as in difficulty, shall we say. Now, you're not suggesting that we should go back to the good old days of medieval living with 6 billion people on the planet. So you've touched on one of the solutions there, resilient cities and or societies, and we have covered that here on Radio EcoShock. Do you have some other ideas of things we should be looking at?
Well, one of the things we're doing with the Dark Mountain Project, it's a cultural project, this is. One of the things we're trying to do is almost sidestep this whole discussion about problems and solutions, because much of the environment movement is focused on this. And it treats the kind of the state of society as a kind of pathology which we need to have a medical cure for, and we need to find a cure, whether it be a technology or a particular system. And that's, you know, a lot of that's very valid. It's not the wrong thing to be doing, but what we're trying to do with the Dark Mountain Project is look from a cultural angle, almost. We're trying to form a cultural movement, and what we're trying to do is examine the stories that we've built our society on, because I think that every society that's ever existed, including ours, has foundation myths, and it has stories that it believes about itself, and they are stories that inform the direction that it goes in. We've just been talking about economic growth, for example, and one of the big foundation stories of our sort of post-enlightenment industrial society is the idea of progress, the idea that every generation is better than the one before, the idea that technology always improves, that the human condition always improves, that life is very linear. You start off at the bottom and you end up at the top. And that's a very, very specific Western kind of ideal of society. And it informs a lot of our ideas. Another of the myths of our society, I think, is the idea of human centrality, the idea that we're separate from nature. This comes from Christianity, and it's bolstered by current philosophy, and it's bolstered by sort of scientific rationalism, the idea that we're this incredible species which is entirely different from anything else, and we can pretty much do what we want because we have the ability to do it. And all of these kind of myths, these stories that we tell ourselves about who we are, they inform the kind of society that we build and the way that we look at the future. And we're trying to question those, and we're trying to come up with new ideas. We're trying to rewrite the stories and look at them in a different way. So we wondered what would happen if you tried to bring together a movement of writers and poets and musicians and artists and thinkers and just anyone who's interested, I mean, you know, as well as artisans and people with practical skills, and start to try and rework some of the stories and question some of the narratives. Because I think that's, you know, while it's not a practical movement, it's not a practical move in the kind of everyday sense, it's, I think, something quite seriously important that we're failing to do. It's almost the root cause of the problem that we've created for ourselves, and I think it needs to be examined again.
And these may be stories of uncivilization?
Yeah, well, I mean, we're calling it uncivilization. It's and we see that as a process, not a place, not a goal. When we talk about uncivilization, we're not talking about a kind of primitivist manifesto. We're talking about a process of unweaving the myths of civilization. We have this wonderful belief in the indestructibility of our civilization, which is something, incidentally, that I think all civilizations have probably had, and all civilizations have collapsed, and there's no reason ours would be any different to that. So we're talking about uncivilizing ourselves in the sense of cutting ourselves off from those myths, standing back, looking at them, asking ourselves why we believe the things that have got us to this point, and what we ought to be believing instead. What's trying to distinguish between our self-image, if you like, as a species and as a culture, and the reality. It's almost like stepping back from your ego as an individual and trying to understand how other people see you rather than the way you see yourself. And that's the kind of thing that we're trying to do. And we're trying to sort of spread these tentacles out into society as a whole and see if they catch on.
We haven't talked much about the majority of the people on this planet, the billions who are not worried about what kind of mobile phone to buy next. From Asia through Africa to South America, the prospects for a just world seem dimmer than ever to me. Would you agree with that?
I think it kind of depends, actually. I think it kind of depends what you mean by a just world. I think that, again, there's a narrative which is that we're the developed world, we're the rich guys and we're the lucky guys, and the poor people out there need to have what we've got. Now, that's obviously true to some degree. I mean, it's clearly true that we have excellent things like, you know, healthcare and transport systems and things to which other people would like access and have a right to have access. But there's also a sense that I think that we have, as I say, we've cannibalized our own culture, we've cannibalized our own economies, and we've created something here in the West which is very fragile, which in other parts of the world, which in some ways are poorer, isn't the case. And if you look at something like climate change, for example, you hear a lot that it will be the poor countries that suffer most from climate change. And again, in some cases, that's obviously true. If you live in Bangladesh, you're going to be in trouble. And there's a lot of action needs to be done to help out vulnerable communities. But there's also a sense that if you live in a country which still has a functioning village economy, for example, if you live in a country which in which the landscape requires you to have skills and to have community and to have, you know, and you've got extended families around you and you've got a sustainable and resilient local economy, then in some ways you might be better off if the global economy collapses than you would be if you were living in a city in the West. So that's one way of looking at it. I think another way of looking at it is that there are, in my first book, the one I wrote before Real England, that was a book called One No Many Yeses, and that was a global journey through what I called the global resistance movement, the kind of anti-capitalist movement. And I spent a lot of time in poor countries, in poorer communities, and I saw then, and it's still the case now, that there really are enormous movements out there in South America and in Africa and in Asia and in Indonesia and all over the place. And they link up in some cases with similar kinds of movements in the Western world. There are enormous movements of people who are rejecting the system. And they're not, you know, what we might call sort of outsiders or hippies or anything. In the West, they're peasants, they're ordinary people, they're farmers, they're tribes people, there are millions of them altogether, and they are working on precisely this kind of alternative, sustainable, resilient community system. And I think in some cases, people in the poor world have a much, much clearer view of the injustices and the weaknesses of the global economy than we do here, because they're less reliant on it and they can see they're at the sharp end. They can see the damage. So in one sense, there's not going to be a smooth path to the kind of global justice that we might once have thought there was. But I think in another sense, there's going to be a lot of anger. And that was one thing you saw at Copenhagen, actually, even from the governments of these poorer countries, a lot of anger from the poor world and the less developed world about just constantly being screwed by the rich again. And I don't think that people will put up with it for much longer. So in one sense, I think you're probably going to see a lot more resistance and organization from people in outside the West.
Well, you've raised some really good points, but you talk about anger, and I worry about as people lose their jobs, as people have to lose perhaps their homes and their cars, the kind of anger that's going to come up in the West. Are we risking a new kind of fascism here at home as living standards decline?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, that's a big concern for me as well. And I think it varies from country to country, but I certainly have the impression in Britain that democracy is really in a very messy state. It's sclerotic. People just do not trust politicians. They don't trust the system. They don't vote. We recently elected a couple of fascist members of the European Parliament, unfortunately, just in the election we had last year. And that's more common in Europe than it is now. You know, not to suggest we're going to see a rerun of the 1930s, but I think that there's going to be a real appetite, actually, for anti-politics movements and for, yes, maybe people from the far right with easy answers. And there is a lot of anger out there. I mean, you certainly see it in the U.S., and you see it increasingly in Europe as well. There's a lot of people who don't want to accept this, don't want to accept the way the world is changing, don't want to accept the fact that things will be straightened and the society will be contracting, and they'll want people to blame. So it's a real worry. I don't really know. I don't really know what to do about it, actually, other than to kind of watch it. But I think that democracy is in a real mess, actually, or what we've come to call democracy is in a real mess, because it's just been bought up by the economy. I think it's a wholly owned subsidiary of the global market, and people don't trust it anymore.
Yeah, just so obvious with what happened to the Obama dream, too.
Well, exactly. I like Barack Obama. I think he's probably a good guy, and I think he's a well-intentioned guy. And I think he probably meant the things he said, but he can't do them.
Yeah.
And maybe he only realized that when he got into office. He can't do them. He's not really running the country. And that's true everywhere, I think.
Well, when we're looking at this 21st century predicament and we're trying to work our way through it, who are some of the thought leaders that we should be exploring?
Gosh, it's hard to say, really. Thought leaders. I mean, some of the people that interest me most are are the deep ecological thinkers, whom there are quite a few in North America. I mean, people like Kirkpatrick Sale in the U.S., for example, or even Illich, who's now dead but was a very important thinker, Theodore Rotzak, some of the really important deep ecologists who are trying to forge a way between the human view of humanity and the human view of the world, because I think another thing that's going to be a real challenge for us is accepting our place within the natural world, which ought to be a fantastic thing for us to accept, because it sees us as kind of embedded in a web of life rather than kind of separate, isolated individuals. But I don't think it's going to appeal to many people. So I find some of the deep ecologists the most interesting people who are out there at the moment. And I think also just people who are talking about and thinking about at local level some of the ways to make things happen. From Subcomandante Marcos of the Zapatistas has always been a great inspiration of mine, because not only is he a poet and a good writer, but he's an activist. He's a man who is deeply embedded in his community, and he's tried to look at how you can make a rural community and a tribal community and a sort of peasant community work in a modern world, in a modern setting, and how you can have almost a strange combination of resistance and peace. And there are all sorts of interesting people like that out there from all sorts of communities in the global south, if you like, who are some of our most interesting people. I mean, I don't see anything personally coming from any mainstream political leaders of any interest at all. And I don't find very much coming from what you might call the traditional left either that has anything really to offer that isn't very tired and dry. And I think that people who are looking at that grassroots level and that level of embedding us back into the world as a whole are the most interesting people for me.
And Paul Kingsnorth, what's next for you?
Well, what's next for me is at the moment I'm putting together the first issue of the Dark Mountain Journal. We're looking for submissions of writing and poetry and art and other things that fit in with our kind of uncivilized manifesto, which you can read on our website. We're holding the first Dark Mountain Festival in Wales next year, and we're going to see how the movement takes off. It's been really amazing and heartening to see how many people have been interested since we launched it in July in quite a low-key way, and we've had people from all over the world, including Canada and North America and all over the world, actually, Indonesia, China. You'd be surprised how far people are coming from, expressing their interest in this and saying, we're so glad that you're saying this because it's what we've been feeling too, and we're quite excited about it. So I think that we might be touching on a nerve, and I think that we might be sort of burrowing into something that a lot of people are feeling, and we hope that we can push that forward and get these debates going and start to sort of move on to the next phase, because it certainly is needed.
Our guest has been Paul Kingsnorth. Read the Dark Mountain Manifesto at dark-mountain.net and find out more at paulkingsnorth.net. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Paul, we've just scratched the surface. I'm hoping you'll come back again, perhaps, in the spring.
I would love to, yes. Thanks very much for having me.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.